Host of the show as well, and I'm really glad to be in the studio with you, Andy. And I want to welcome everybody tuning in for the first time and everybody returning. This show, the Revolution Nothing Less show, is a show about a real revolution. What do we mean by this? Let's let you hear it straight from Bob Avakian, the author of A Whole New Framework for Human Emancipation, what we call the New Communism.
The choices in this election are a damning exposure of this whole system. This is Bob Avakian, Revolution number 101. In these messages, I have done a lot of analysis of what is actually represented by this election and the opposing candidates, Trump and Harris. At the same time, it can be boiled down to this. We are being told to choose between a lunatic, racist, woman-hating, all-around fascist Donald Trump and a genocidal war criminal, Kamala Harris. When these are the choices offered by a system, it is time to recognize that this system is a thoroughly rotten, monstrously criminal, massively destructive, thoroughly outmoded system, long past the time when it can represent anything positive. It is time to look seriously for solutions outside and beyond this system. It is time for a revolution to overthrow and uproot this whole system and bring into being a fundamentally different and much better system. It is time to join the national campaign to spread these social media messages and the word about this revolution while you're learning more about it. Time to go to revcom.us, get into We Need and We Demand, a whole new way to live, a fundamentally different system. Time to become part of the RevCom Corps for the emancipation of humanity, actively and urgently working for this revolution.
That was Bob Avakian, the revolutionary leader, as Sansara said before, who's brought forward a whole new way to emancipate humanity. And this message, the 101st message, is extremely timely in this week of the 2024 elections when the future really does hang in the balance. He says that this is a time for a revolution to overthrow and uproot this whole system and bring into being a fundamentally different and much better system. And he says, this is a time to join the national campaign to spread these social media messages. This is Bob Avakian's, as I said, 101st message. You can find his messages at Bob Avakian Official on all social media platforms. This is very timely guidance, very timely analysis. What is to be done in this time? So you need to be going to these every day. And he says that while you're learning about it, you should go to our website, revcom.us, and look at the pamphlet, look at the brochure. It's right at the top of the website. We need and we demand a whole new way to live, a fundamentally different system. This needs to become the watchword of millions of people, the demand of millions of people in this coming period. And last, he says, you need to become part of the RevCom Corps for the Emancipation of Humanity. That's RevCom for Revolutionary Communist Corps, a group of organized, disciplined people who are getting prepared for and going out among the masses of people, spreading the word of these Bob Avakian social media messages and working every day for a revolution to bring about the emancipation of humanity here and all over the world.
So every week on this show, we bring alive the need for this revolution, and we bring you the voice of Bob Avakian, the leadership he's providing. I want to let you know what we have in our episode this week. At the end of the show, really the most important part of today's show, we're going to show an excerpt of the interview that Andy and I did with Bob Avakian a couple years ago when on this channel, where after these extensive, expansive interviews about his life, his development as a revolutionary, the changes in the world that require a revolution, lessons that he's learned. I mean, it's a very expansive interview. At the end, Andy asked him, after 60 years of dedicating himself to fighting for liberation, fighting for revolution, fighting to stay on the revolutionary road, but also to advance the science of revolution, what sustains him? And the answer he gives is profound. You're going to get to know him on a tremendously deeper level. You'll find inspiration. You'll find a perspective that could strengthen your own understanding of how to live a life that contributes to emancipation. And you'll have a sense of who we have in this leader, how precious this is. So that's going to be the second half of our show. Before that, we're going to stay on the themes that Bob Avakian just introduced about the complete illegitimacy of this system, the so-called choices it's presenting in this election. So we're going to share some excerpts of a conversation, a forum that Andy was part of with Paul Street, the historian, moderated by Sam Goldman of the Refuse Fascism podcast. It was sponsored by the Revolution Nothing Less show and the Refuse Fascism podcast about the coming elections when the future hangs in the balance. So we'll play some of that. And then I will be talking about the just raw, brutal hatred of women that is being fostered and unleashed on a different level, on a whole out of the basement, off the chains level with the Trump final closing argument for his presidential campaign.
Good evening and welcome to the 2024 election. The future hangs in the balance. A virtual forum sponsored by the Refuse Fascism podcast and the RNL Revolution Nothing Less show. I'm Sam Goldman, host of the Refuse Fascism podcast and host of tonight's discussion.
So as I mentioned just a moment ago, just a few nights ago, Andy was part of a forum online hosted by Sam Goldman of Refuse Fascism, together with Paul Street, who's a historian and somebody who's been very active in exposing the fascism of Trump and writing extensively about this. And it was called The 2024 Election, The Future Hangs in the Balance. And so we want to share some of what happened in that forum. I will be honest, we were so torn in selecting excerpts of this because it was I was in the studio audience, the live audience. It was a very lively event, and I felt the people in the room kind of jolted out to the edge of their seats thinking about just how unnormal and uncalm this election period and the future days and weeks are likely to be. How did you feel doing it? And what do you want to say about what we're going to share?
Well, it felt the way that you said. People were on the edge of their seat. I've done a lot of programs, the Revolution books in different places, and people here were like wide-eyed through a lot of it. And that's because we were trying to bring to life, that something that really stood out to me, that we've been talking on this show, and Bob Avakian's been writing about for the last 2 years, that with this upcoming election and around it, and the sharp divide between the two sections of the ruling class in this country, the fascist Republican Party and the business as usual, which means genocide. It means the oppression of immigrants at the border and of women, as you're about to speak about later on this program, that really there's something terrible that's emerging out of this system in this country. But that very sharp conflict at the top of society holds the potential for people to be jolted out of the normalcy of this system and the possibility to be forming the kind of organization and force to be able to overthrow this system and make a revolution to bring about a truly emancipating future. And one of the things about this program is that it was, because it was a conversation, we started to work with the ideas. What is it going to look like? What about this? And we kept having to say, we don't have a crystal ball, but here's a likely scenario. Here's a different scenario. And like you said, it was hard to pick a section of it. It was that was just people were really like, oh my God, this is happening. They saw the rally at Madison Square Garden with Trump. They saw, people have seen that they nightly are watching this genocide. And I went into a whole thing on it, which we're not going to show today. But, you know, the genocide is being committed by Israel with the full backing of the Biden-Harris administration, and how supporting them in this election is being complicit in genocide. So that was my first point, just how excited people were to actually, and anxious to get into it. What I've heard since is that people are now wrestling with these questions. Second, I wanted to say that a lot of people had not really seriously considered that we are serious about an actual revolution. Mm-hmm. You know, and this, oh, you're talking about really making a revolution. How are you going to do that when you're so small? How is it going to grow? That was the second thing that struck me through the conversation, including with my comrade and colleagues, you know, Sam Goldman from Refuse Fascism and Street. And the last thing that was really hit me was, it was a conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not like doing, just having, we're going to make this point, that point. It was very back and forth, and people were following it, and there were missteps and all this kind of stuff, but they were like, it was actually gave people a sense, and this is what I've learned since, it gave people a sense, wow, we should be having these conversations. We have to be talking about this. And that was a point that I explicitly made in this. So that's, I mean, maybe that's a bit too much, but that's what, that's the things I was very excited by doing it.
All right. So we did settle on one portion of this conversation we want to share with you. You can watch the whole thing on our YouTube channel under the live selection of videos. And let's just listen in.
I have been trying to tell people for a long time, stop focusing just on the horse race, start focusing on how you're going to respond. And we have, yes, a number of scenarios, and we have to be flexible, and we have to have a solid understanding of just what's at stake here and how this conflict between these different wings of the ruling class and these different parts of the population are going to create chaos, and but also create an opening for revolutionary progress. And I think our project is to get off of this blue versus red polarization, which is killing us and crippling our politics. And the key word is in a word that Avakian uses. We have to work on people. We have to talk about this all the time. Get past this f-ing red v. blue stuff and start understanding the real polarization that we need. We need to repolarize this country. We need to talk to everybody we know about the need to repolarize this country. Stop calling red America, stop calling fascist America red, okay? Try brown, as in the color of Hitler's brown shirts, okay? We need to repolarize this country between with the people, the masses of people, versus the capitalist ruling class that has let this take place, that has its own divisions, and the capitalist imperialist system that is red, white, and blue. We have to repolarize that, and we really have to start organizing our asses off. We need to start going out and talking to everybody we know. We got to be knocking on doors. We've got to be visible and present out on the in the public squares and on the street corners, and it's really important to push Avakian's work. It's really extremely important. Right? Nobody has been breaking this down as consistently and as brilliantly within a revolutionary framework. No one's been doing a better job on this. No leader has been really. A lot of this is predicted. A lot of this is what Avakian is saying, where we were headed, and it's happening now. So,
what does it mean that the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the most powerful army in the world has said that the candidate for president, the former president who could be the next president, is a fascist? Kind of a big deal. And his former chief of staff, Trump's former chief of staff, who's also a general, General Kelly. And I'm not a fan of either man, just by the way. These are war criminals, and we can, if we had the time, we could go into the Iraq War, and they're really horrific resumes. But the fact that they are coming out and calling this regime fascist, this is a breaking of the norm of the decorum between two sections of the ruling class who agree to disagree and have an election in order to
rope the people into accepting this system that they live under. This is breaking apart right in front of your faces.
Let's start
thinking about this. Trump will not accept anything other than being in power and being dictator for more than one day. That's just a ruse. But what are they going to do? Who has Biden and the, who's still president, just by the way, it's kind of hard to find him, but he is still president, and Kamala Harris, what are they going to do? They still command the armed forces in this situation. But there is National Guards in places like Texas and different states that I don't want to get too involved in speculation, but there's going to be there's likely to be very sharp conflicts and maybe even armed conflicts and maybe even conflicts between sections of the police forces, military forces. What difference would it make if there was a force that was saying, this is not, we have no future in this. And we have a document from the RevComs called Building Up the Basis to Go for the Whole Thing with a Real Chance to Win, Strategic Orientation and Practical Approach. In this, one of the points, that's not the first thing we're going to be doing, but in this situation where you have so many people in this military who come from the most oppressed strata, who are going to be called upon potentially to fire on and to corral people who are just like them, from poor backgrounds, from deprived backgrounds, from racial minorities, national minorities. There's a potential in that to begin to split things apart in the favor of the revolution. You know, that's not the immediate task in front of us, but there is a strategy for that in this pamphlet, in this strategy. And in fact, in this pamphlet, it says that at such a time when things really are joined like that, they'd be offered amnesty to come over to our side. People have no imagination of a situation that's radically different than what you've been accustomed to, and that hasn't happened, as Bob Avakian has said now, for years since the Civil War. That's a very shocking thing. It was very shocking in 1860 when suddenly states along the Mason-Dixon line, the line that divided the slave states from North, towns were split apart, families were split apart. People were forced to confront something very radically different. That is potentially happening right now. In fact, it's likely to be a situation of really intense crisis. And when you have that kind of situation, there is a chance, not a guarantee, as Bob Avakian has said, but there is a chance. If there are people who increasingly become aware that there's a whole other way we could be living, there's different principles that we could be living by, a different constitution, a different economy, a different education system, a different health system, we're not going to have nuclear weapons anymore, we're going to sustain the anything in the economy that isn't ecologically sustainable, we're not doing that. We're going to cut off all this parasitic exploitation of people around the world. People look at Gaza, and like myself and millions of others, they recoil from the horror of it. We're going to break all that. In this situation, people might be able to be one if we do what needs to be done. And those of you listening who haven't been convinced, get out there and spread this. Spread, and when by this, I mean what Bob Avakian is bringing to you in his social media messages every week. If we bring that to people now, they'll start to see what's underneath all these things that are happening, what's the cause of it in the system, and they're also going to find that there's a whole other way we could be living, and there's a road to get to that way. And we're 10 days out, so that's why I'm going very heavily in this direction to because it's what's needed and what could be possible. And I think a lot of people might, just the last point on Sam's question, a lot of people might take to the street to protest. That's going to be a good thing. We got to get out there among them and say, here's where this has to go. Here's where this has to go. We have to transform this into a struggle for a whole different way to be living, for a revolutionary struggle and begin getting to work on creating the actual basis to be able to do that, because that's a big question. It's not going to happen on November 8th, okay? But that's when the situation that's developing is one where we can go to work on it and start bringing this into being for real and getting on the road to a far better society and not the absolute horrible future that's represented by either side in this and both sides of this election.
All right, Sansara, that was a small part of the conversation I had with Paul Street, hosted by Sam Goldman. You can find the whole thing on our YouTube channel. Click under Live and you can see the whole thing there. It was a lot of fun. We got into a number of questions on and the possibility for revolution and what it would be for and how it could come out of this current situation. But mainly we jolted people to be looking at the increasing craziness and the intensifying situation and the possibility of revolution, which is also the title of a group of social media posts from Bob Avakian, numbers 63 through 66. And they're packaged together as a playlist at Bob Avakian Official on the Substack and on Instagram and on other social media platforms. And if you listen to all of those, you're going to get a good sense of what's up, the kind of scenarioizing that he does there. At the foundation of all of this is the first 11 of his social media posts. And this is just really important. We're going into a tumultuous time, and the more you understand what's happening, why it's happening, and where the interests of the people of this country and all of humanity lie, that's what you're getting from Bob Avakian. So I want to really commend that you take that little taste of what we did the other night as just a beginning introduction to the heart of it all in those social media posts. So next up is Sansara did a commentary on the unbelievable and extraordinarily putrid, woman-hating program of Donald Trump and the MAGA fascists. So watch this.
You want just one example of what makes this whole system completely illegitimate and bankrupt? A core part of Trump's closing argument for president is brutal, raw hatred of women, priming his foaming-at-the-mouth followers with the promise of violent revenge. Listen to this from Tucker Carlson at a rally with Trump.
Kamala Harris shouldn't have a job. She has no skills. How did we wind up with a system where Kamala Harris, you couldn't change the tire on your truck, much less drive it? How did she wind up at the top of the pyramid? And then once she's there, she lectures you like you did something. It's too much. You can't allow that. If you allow your two-year-old to smear the contents of his diapers on the wall of your living room and you do nothing about it, if you allow your 14-year-old to light a joint at the breakfast table, if you allow your hormone-addled 15-year-old daughter to like slam the door of her bedroom and give you the finger, you're going to get more of it. No. There has to be a point at which dad comes home. Yeah, that's right. Dad comes home. And he's pissed. Dad is pissed. And when dad gets home, you know what he says? You've been a bad girl. You've been a bad little girl, and you're getting a vigorous spanking right now. And no. It's not going to hurt me more than it hurts you. No, it's not. I'm not going to lie. This is going to hurt you a lot more than it hurts me. And you earned this. You're getting a vigorous spanking because you've been a bad girl.
This is a pornographically charged fantasy about inflicting violence on a teenage girl. Think about it. Tucker mentions three kids, but only when he comes to the 15-year-old does he mention that she is female. And not just female. A hormone-addled teenage girl. He is sexualizing her, conjuring how her body is changing, how her sexuality is awakening. And Tucker is saying that just by wanting to assert herself, as every teenager does, she is being very bad. She deserves to be punished. Punished by a man. The dad. The patriarch. The enforcer. So this dad administers a vigorous spanking. Finally, Tucker emphasizes that this spanking will be violent. It will cause pain. And the man is going to enjoy inflicting this pain on this girl. Think about the audience that is hearing this. The pornography-consuming men and boys raised on the idea that what it means to be a man is to keep the bitches in line.
Me teaching people how I managed females in those scenarios, how I controlled their emotion, why they obeyed me.
Tucker's abuse fantasy is a metaphor. It is not just a metaphor for Kamala Harris, who these fascist bros are eager to call low IQ, undeserving, someone who allegedly slept her way to the top, someone who is being handled by pimps.
Her and her pimp handlers will destroy our country.
But let's give Harris her due. As horrific as Kamala Harris actually is, as much as she is an enforcer of mass incarceration, mass murder in Gaza, and so many other crimes of this system, Kamala Harris is capable. She has earned her place near the top of this grotesque system. But these men are not just furious at Harris. They are furious at all women. They are furious at women outpacing men in college. They are furious that some men now have to answer to female bosses. They are furious that sometimes men are held accountable for sexual assault. They are furious that millions of women expect their boyfriends and their husbands to treat them with respect. They are furious that more women than in any previous generation have the financial independence to leave abusive relationships, to have children on their own, or not to have children at all. Meanwhile, many of the jobs that men used to rely on have dried up because of automation and globalization. These men are furious that here and all over the world, women's long pent-up fury has repeatedly burst forth, defying thousands of years of tradition's chains. And these men are furious as well that LGBTQ people, especially trans people, have challenged traditional notions of what it means to be a man or a woman. No, the oppression of women has not been ended. One in six women in this country will still be raped or sexually assaulted. Women still don't have pay equity with men. The culture is still filled with degradation of women. Young boys and girls are taught that sex should involve violence and domination. But even the partial advances that women have won are too much for these men, shaped as they are by millennia of patriarchal domination that continues to be woven into our society today. So now, these men are out for revenge. And this imaginary 15-year-old girl Tucker fantasizes about sexually and violently assaulting is a stand-in for all women. And who is the champion of this promised orgy of revenge against women? Donald f***ing Trump.
Daddy Trump! Daddy Trump! Daddy Trump! Daddy Trump! Daddy Trump!
Trump, who waxes on about the size of an athlete's penis at a presidential rally.
He took showers with the other pros. They came out of there. They said, oh, my God. That's unbelievable.
Trump, who openly basks in his ability to grab him by the pussy.
You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab him by the pussy.
Trump, who promises to deliver the supposedly God-ordained destiny of a powerful America defined by rugged, aggressive, militant white masculinity, where men are once again kings in their patriarchal families. Trump, who handpicked the cold-hearted theocratic justices who overturned women's fundamental right to abortion, so that now, across this country, tens of thousands of women are being forced to have children against their will. So that now, thousands of women are bleeding out in parking lots, suffering organ failure, even losing their lives. Recently, the Democrats have been speaking to this threat against women. But let's get real. These Democrats have never and will never fight these women-hating fascists the way they need to be fought. These Democrats only give lip service to women when they need your vote and need to keep you believing in their system. Then they go back to their decades-long pattern of seeking common ground with these fascists, ceding the moral high ground to them, and channeling your rage and your hopes and the limits of your imagination back into their system. But it is this system, the system of capitalism and imperialism, that spawned these fascists. This system has the oppression of women woven deeply into its very foundation and functioning. And the nature of this system has ensured that, fight as women might, any advances they win will be partial, and these advances will be under constant assault. And now, the antagonism between the deep desire and yearning of women to be free of all this patriarchal bullshit and the vengeance being sought by these women-hating MAGA maniacs is coming to a head. This is going to be resolved one way or the other. With so much at stake, let us be very clear. There is only one way to resolve this positively. It is through a real revolution that overthrows this truly monstrous system of capitalism and imperialism and brings into being a fundamentally different and much better system and way of life. A system where women, men, and differently gendered people come together to forge new ways of relating with full equality and respect as part of a larger fight to end oppression and exploitation in every form. This is possible. Bob Avakian has forged a new communism, a whole new framework for human emancipation that goes way beyond and in some important ways is very different than even the best of the revolutions of the past. And a core part of this is recognizing that the fight for the complete liberation of women will be a crucial component in propelling and driving forward not only the revolutionary struggle to overthrow this system, but to continue the revolution within the new socialist society itself in order to advance on the road towards the final aim of human emancipation. So instead of allowing your fury and your aspirations to be channeled back into the killing confines of this system through its Democratic Party, bring all that into the revolution. Follow at Bob Avakian Official today and reach out to us. Reach out to me at the address on the screen to dig into this together and to get organized to stand up against this assault as we work for revolution. Let me close with this powerful truth from Bob Avakian.
Here is another profound truth. Even with all the ways that the heavy chains of hundreds and thousands of years of oppressive tradition weigh down on the masses of people and place a heavy burden, particularly on the half of humanity that is female, there is a deep yearning to be free of all this, which not only leads to imaginary hopes of supernatural salvation, but also erupts in unrestrained fury right in this real world. And that fury needs to be fully called forth, given a scientific revolutionary expression, focused toward the emancipation of all the oppressed and exploited of the world, and ultimately all humanity, directed to fighting against the fundamental source of all the suffering. This system of capitalism imperialism, with its suffocating and brutal patriarchal male supremacy, along with all its other outrages. This takes on even more powerful meaning and urgent importance in the current situation in this country and others, where the forceful assertion of raw misogyny, hatred of women, and patriarchal subjugation of women is becoming more blatant and unbridled, focused to a significant degree now in the escalating moves to even further deny women control over their own lives and their very bodies, with the right to abortion and even birth control being brought under mounting attack. Right now, this slogan and call needs to be taken up broadly and made a powerful material force. Break the chains. Unleash the fury of women as a mighty force for revolution.
That was a very powerful commentary. And when you think about those millennia of the oppression of women and the possibility to overthrow the system that this oppression of women is woven into the capitalist imperialist system in this country, the most powerful empire in history, what a difference that could make. And that chance is sitting before us now. That should fill everyone with the determination to do what needs to be done. Now, in the program I did with Paul Street that we spoke about earlier, we talked about how this revolution was for the emancipation of all of humanity, for overcoming all forms of exploitation and oppression. And one of the things I did on that program is I held this up that I referred to earlier. It was in Bob Avakian's Message 101 with which we began this program that says we need and we demand a whole new way to live, a fundamentally different system. And this concentrates some of the key points of a radically new society led by the Constitution for the new Socialist Republic in North America, written by Bob Avakian. And I read this paragraph, these two sentences on the back of this broadsheet, this demand. And I want to read them again because I think we're in the midst of this election season. Some of you will watch this right before the election, some in the immediate aftermath, and this is going to be tumultuous over the next weeks and months, I expect. But Bob Avakian has said, we can no longer afford to allow these imperialists to continue to dominate the world and to determine the destiny of humanity. And it is a scientific fact that humanity does not have to live this way. And so this is what's on the agenda for humanity. And yet many people don't see it, or if they begin to wake up and say, my God, what do we do? But the forces right now for revolution are so small. So just let me play two sentences from Bob Avakian's social media number 8, which I referred to earlier.
With such an organized revolutionary force, it is possible to have a growing impact on all of society. Changing the terms of how masses of people see things and how every institution has to respond. With thousands organized into the ranks of the revolution, millions can be won to revolution. And with millions won to revolution, there could be a real possibility for this revolution to win.
And so with that, let's move to this very moving closing segment of Bob Avakian at the end of the three-part interview that Sansara and I did with him when I just asked him, what sustains you? And I thought maybe it'd be a brief answer, but he went into this and it's just extraordinary. As you said earlier, it's a lesson there of how we could all be living. You know, you've been doing this for a long time. You've been leading a revolution. You've been a leader before that. And I think people would want to know a bit more about, even as it's been contained in what you said, what sustains you? What makes you not only not give up, but continue to strive and develop the science and to struggle with the masses of people, to struggle with all of us who are following you and just stating a willingness to struggle with all these masses to get into the one way out for them? And then also maybe say something, even as you've just covered a lot of it, to those people who are in this movement and those people who don't even know about it yet but need to be in this movement of where are they going to get that inspiration, that courage, that conviction, that sustenance to really put it all on the line, as you just said, to really live and if necessary, make whatever sacrifice is required to bring about a world where humanity could really flourish.
Well, I mean, as the first part, the most fundamental thing terms of anyone being sustained is having a scientific approach to reality, being grounded in that and consistently applying a scientific method and approach to understand the contradictions that you're up against, to understand the deeper driving forces of things, to understand that everything we've been talking about, all the horrors, are rooted in this system, and that there is a way to eliminate all this by uprooting and overthrowing this system and replacing it with something much better. So the most important thing and the most basic thing is having that scientific method and approach, but it's not something you get once. You have to keep on struggling to apply it in a living way to a constantly changing reality and to deepening your understanding of that scientific method, including learning from your mistakes, the things you did wrong, but also learning from what, you know, the things you did right and what results that produced and then building on that. So that's the most fundamental thing. As far as, you know, more personal thing, I think it's the same as everybody else who's part of this. That, you know, you come to see that this world is, first of all, intolerable, and second of all, that it's unnecessary. And once you see those two things, then you can't, you know, not apply yourself to actually bringing about the change that's needed, the fundamental revolutionary change that's needed. It's just, you know, it's you again, the science keeps you grounded, keeps you going through all the difficulties and contradictions. But there's a basic stand that what the, you know, people in the world are being put through is completely intolerable and completely unnecessary. I mean, I could talk about some of my own personal development in this, but, you know, as I've said before, you know, I consider myself extremely fortunate. I grew up in a city which, on the one hand, was a, you know, intellectual center. You know, I grew up in a middle-class family. I lived in the Berkeley Hills, where all the better-off people live, you know, and I, because of that, I was able to be exposed to a lot of, you know, knowledge, but not just knowledge, a lot of, you know, a lot of intellectual curiosity was encouraged, and I was able to, you know, have a lot of resources to read books and I used to go to, you know, Shakespeare plays, and I went to plays by Leroy Jones too, and he was called Leroy Jones, you know. But I was very encouraged and was interested in a broad array of cultural and intellectual things. That, and I had the situation where I could do that because of how I grew up. But then, you know, my life changed dramatically. I mean, for one thing, I'll give my parents credit. I mean, partly because my mom was religious, very religious. My dad was religious. My mom was very religious. They sent me to YMCA camp from the time I was 9 years old. And the one thing I was, you know, really good about that, or the one thing that really stands out, is that the YMCA in Berkeley, which is one sponsoring the camp, was integrated. You go to the Y was integrated. You go to the camp that I went to for 5 years, it was integrated. And not just were there, you know, for example, black people at the camp, but they were the cabins that you slept in, the group you were part of was integrated. So, you know, I still remember, I won't say his full name, I remember one dude, Wesley, was in a cabin with me and his cousin, you know, for the years I went there. And, you know, to be honest, when I was a kid, I was kind of spoiled too, you know, coming up, and they didn't like me that much, you know. I had some interactions with them that made an impression on me. You know, like one time I got really homesick at camp. And I knew that some of these kids didn't like me very much. And, I was 9 or 10, I went and I threw myself down in my bunk in the cabin. And either Wesley or his cousin came in and started comforting me and saying, you know, you're not that bad. You know, you shouldn't feel that bad. People don't hate you that much, you know. and it made me feel better. You know, and it made a deep impression on me, and so did the whole thing of going to that camp. But, you know, and then I went to middle school or junior high school, as it was called, and, you know, there were very few black people there, but in ninth grade, my best friend, John, was black, and, you know, we got pretty close. We did some singing stuff together and had a lot of fun together, and that had an impression on me. And then I considered, like, one of the great things about Berkeley was that it only has one public high school. And so when you go to that public high school, you know, you're thrown together with everybody. Like, there were three junior highs when I went there. They're not there now in the same way. But it was Garfield, where I went to, which was overwhelmingly white, some Latinos, and about 25 black people. Then there was Willard and Burbank, where most of the Latinos and, you know, large numbers of black people went, especially Burbank, which was in Southwest Berkeley. And we all came together. You know, at that time, the high school was like three years, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. We all came together. And I still remember my first day of high school. They had an orientation. And, you know, if you came from Garfield, there was all this racist
And like, oh man, you're gonna go down to Berkeley High and there are gonna be all these black kids there from Burbank and Willard, and you're gonna get your ass kicked and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, they had an assembly the first day for all the new students. And so I got there late and I was looking for a seat and I couldn't find, I mentioned this in my memoir, but you know, I was looking for a seat and I couldn't find a seat. And I'm walking all around looking for a seat. And then I went by this one guy who was kind of slouched against the wall like this and his feet were sticking out. And I said, I don't want to get into any here. So I walked very gingerly around him. And as I did, he turned to me and said, hey man, you stepped on my dogs. I didn't step on his feet at all, just to be clear. I said, no, I didn't. He said, yes, you did, man. You stepped on my dogs. And then that was all there was to it. Now, this dude whose name was Odell, he and I became friends later on. We were in a singing group together when I was a senior in high school. You know, I used to see him out in the hallway, you know, because he didn't go to class all that much. But, you know, he was creative. So I'd see him out in the hallway when I'm going to class, you know, and I'd say, hey, Odell, what are you doing, man? How come you're not in class? He'd say, I'm writing songs. So, you know, then he'd be writing songs for our group, you know. I remember he had one that was called Chuck is Good for You. It was all about, you know, eating good food was good for you. But so, you know, that was Odell, you know, and you go through changes. At first, it's like, you stepped on my dogs. And then we're in a singing group together, and they're telling me, hey, man, step back here a little bit. We don't want your white ass sticking out too much when we're doing our routines. So this is all part of the really great experience you have. You know, I had many experiences like this. I made a lot of friends. I didn't make friends to make a point. I made friends because I liked people. You know, some of them were white, some of them were Japanese, some of them were Latino, a number of them were black. But there were people I liked. I got to know them in sports. I got to know them in singing class and this kind of thing. They became my friends. You know what? Friends are people in your heart, okay? Mm-hmm. I don't mean something superficial. You know, oh, I got a bunch of black friends. I mean, these are people in your heart, okay? These people that, you know, you go to their house and they come to your house and you talk all kinds of each other about what's going on, you know, and you talk on the phone back in those days. And I don't know what the we talked about, but we talk about it for hours. You know, so these are people in your heart. And then you see what people are being put through. Just, you know, the daily shit and the bigger shit. And, you know, my mom always taught me, you know, as a good Christian, that you should care about other people. That's the kind of Christianity she was about. You should care about other people. So, I cared about my friends, not just because my mom told me to, although that had an influence on me, but I cared about my friends because they were here. These are my friends, and you're doing all this shit. Plus, I love the culture they were part of. I love being in a singing group. I mean, I could get into old stories about that. You know, it was a lot of fun. You know, I can remember, I guess I am going to tell a story. I remember one time we went to Live Oak Park, which is the main park in, one of the main parks in Berkeley, and I could tell more stories about that, but we don't have time for that. And we were going to do, our group was going to do sing for a dance there. And we're walking, you know, past the basketball courts, getting ready to go into the auditorium to do the singing. And a friend, and our lead singer was my friend Sam. And a friend of his was playing basketball, and he's coming over to get a drink of water. And he says, Sam, what the f*** are you doing here? He said, well, I'm here to sing with my group. You can't sing, Sam. Yeah, I can, man. So then they had to do a spaniel song. They had to have a sing-off. Guy challenged Sam to sing. So they did a verse and a half, and the other guy gave up because Sam could really sing. So, you know, this was all, you know, this I love this. This was all part of, like, you know, something that, you know, just, you know, made my life rich. And then you're going to tell me that you're going to do this and that to my friends. And then you're going to do this and that to all these other people that are just like my friends. I mean, Sam took me out to his house. We went out to East Oakland. He lived right at the edge of East Oakland, right by 98th Avenue, I think it is. And in those days, San Leandro was right next to East Oakland. And you didn't go in San Leandro if you were black back in those days. And there was a creek and a fence right by where Sam lived. And that was the dividing line. You know, you didn't go into San Leandro. Here, my friend Sam, he couldn't go into San Leandro. It was right across the creek because he'd get jumped on. So I'm saying, what kind of f***ing world is this? So that was a big thing to me, you know. And then, you know, the civil rights movement was jumping off, and then, you know, more militant and revolutionary forces like the Black Panther Party came forward, and I was in college at that time. You know, I had recovered from a serious illness, and I had an ambition. I wanted to learn a whole bunch of languages. I wanted to be a Renaissance man, you know, be able to speak at least 5 or 6 languages and read literature in all these different languages, you know. And I was taking all kinds of literature courses, and I had a favorite professor who was Italian, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I was, you know, I was enjoying my time, but I also was still thinking about all these big things going on. And then the Black Panther Party came along. You know, and I was devastated by the death of Malcolm X, like a lot of people were, millions and millions of people, and more than that around the world. And the Black Panther Party came along, and, you know, well, I could go back, you know, just since you asked me this question, I'm going to get into it. You know, so I mentioned my friend Billy, you know, so about when I was still in college, but just, you know, maybe about 1965 or something, I was down at this rec center in Southwest Berkeley. It used to be called the Grove Rec Center, but it's not called Grove anymore. But I was down there, and my friend Billy was playing basketball. He was a great basketball player. And then, you know, after they finished up, he introduced me to this dude named Weasel, whose nickname was Weasel. And they'd played against each other in high school. You know, Weasel went to McClyman's High School in West Oakland, and Billy went to Berkeley High, and they played a great game. But unfortunately, McClyman's won, and our high school that Billy played for lost by 1 point in overtime. And it was a bitter thing, but they were friends, Billy and Weasel. So Billy and I talked a while, and then he introduced me to Weasel, and Weasel and I started talking. And, you know, Weasel was interested, as I was, in all this going on. So, you know, we kept on talking, and then he asked me to give him a ride home. So I gave him a ride home. We went over to his house, and we stayed up till 2 o'clock in the morning drinking coffee and talking with his mom, as well as him, of course. You know, the three of us talking about what was going on with black people in America and all the shit this imperialist ruling class was doing in Vietnam and the Congo and all this kind of stuff. I still remember that very vividly, this staying up till 2 in the morning. And then I hung out with Weasel for a while. And then one day he said to me, you know, there's just going to be this cultural program going on at the community college in Oakland. I think it's called Merritt now. And so I said, you know, he said, why don't you come on down there? It's an Afro-American cultural program. So I went down there, and, you know, I was, I think, one of two white people in the audience, but that was fine. And Bobby Seale turned out to be the MC. And he was hilarious. I mean, he could do great impressions of all kinds of people. He did an impression of Bill Cosby back in the day. He was down on Bill Cosby for doing I Spy, being a CIA agent, and he was mocking Bill Cosby, imitated John Kennedy, all this kind of shit. And I thought, you know, he was great, you know, as an MC of this program. And so then the program ended, and I'm starting to leave, and this guy comes up to me, and he says, who are you, Socrates? And I said, no. And then it turned out it was Huey Newton. And then we started having a discussion about what's going on with black people, black liberation, revolution. And he said to me, you know, are you part of the CP? Because he's trying to figure out why I was there. First, he wanted to know if I was Socrates. Then he wanted to know if I was in the CP. Are you in the Communist Party? And I said, no. He said, that's good. They're not revolutionary. Are you in Progressive Labor Party? I said, no. He said, that's good. They pretend to be revolutionary, but they're not revolutionary either. And then we got into a discussion, and he was running down about how revolution could succeed, especially for black people in America, because although they might be a minority in America, the at least 2/3, maybe 3/4 of the world was with them. So it's possible they could make revolution here. And that was, you know, somewhat naive. It wasn't a fully developed scientific approach. But it made an impression on me, and this whole discussion made an impression on me. And then I was working at Ramparts magazine, and Eldridge Cleaver got out of prison on the basis of getting a job at Ramparts. So we were talking all the time, and I used to go over to his house, and as I mentioned, I talked to him on the phone sometime. And, you know, and this just got me, you know, much deeper into understanding that we needed a revolution. And I just bring it to a close by saying none of the things that I've mentioned that propelled me in this direction have gotten better. It's not that, you know, yeah, there's more black middle class, there's more women able to do this and that, but these terrible forms of oppression, not just to people, I mean, you know, the whole Vietnam War thing, mm-hmm. all the atrocities that you learned about, I took that war very seriously. I took time to make up my mind. When I was in the free speech movement, we had a sit-in in the administration building for a couple of days and finally won our demands. But all the leaders of it, or almost all of them, were against the Vietnam War. And I remember Mario Savio, the main leader, got up and talked about what the administration was doing against us was the same type of thing that the government of our government was doing in Vietnam. And I kind of didn't like that because I wasn't sure, you know, how I felt about Vietnam. But I was studying. I was going into the library and I was reading up on all the different, you know, things that were being analyses about Vietnam, and I was reading about the commission that was set up to oversee the, you know, the situation in Vietnam, International Commission, and they were reporting that it was the U.S. side that was violating all the agreements. You know, and these kind of things are going around in my mind, you know, and I'm thinking and studying and everything. And then, as I've said a number of times, I woke up in you know, the spring of 1965. Got the newspaper, and here's this great big article about Selma, Alabama, and the Pettus Bridge and the attack on the civil rights marchers, and that was it for me. I said, you know, how in the f*** can these people, this government that claims it's bringing freedom to the people of Vietnam and getting rid of these terrible communist tyrants, how in the f*** can they be bringing freedom to the people in Vietnam? Why would they even be trying to do that when look what they're doing in this country and look what the government is allowing to go on right here? And that was it for me. So, you know, all these things came together, but none of this has gotten better. You know, if anything, it's gotten worse. The environment, the whole thing of the environment was just starting, the environmental danger and crisis was just beginning to be recognized at that time. Some people saw where things were headed. But it's gotten obviously worse over decades, and it's accelerating all the time. And, you know, the danger of nuclear war, all these things have not gotten better. And, the people that I care about, that I've learned about, not just the people I grew up with, but the people around the world that I've learned to care about, when I've learned about their situation, to me, for me to give up would be betraying all those people. It'd be like turning your back on your best friends. So it's fundamentally the science that's the foundation, and that, you know, you need to keep deepening and applying and grasping and learning, or else you will go off course. But there's also a thing that I think everybody who gets into this revolution becomes, you know, feels, that right here you feel like what people are being put through, you just can't go along with it. You just can't stand by and watch it happen. You can't live with yourself if you don't do everything you can, especially when you know it's unnecessary and a better world actually is possible. You can't give up. Yes, you can get discouraged. You know, when there's defeats, when there's setbacks, big ones, you know, gigantic ones, like when China went off the socialist road, was taken off the socialist road, and the revolution was betrayed there, and capitalism was restored, and it's emerged as an imperialist power instead of a revolutionary stronghold for the people of the world. Those things are discouraging, but you bear down with the science, and you keep in your heart why you got into this in the first place, and what it is you're in this for. And that's why I don't give up. So that's what I would say about that.